Hello, flight instructors and NAFI members. John Niehaus, Director Program Development for the National Association of Flight Instructors, welcoming you back to another episode of the NAFI More Right Rudder Podcast, the podcast for flight instructors on the go. And today I'm super happy to announce that once again, Avemco is sponsoring this podcast. Now, if you're not familiar, Avemco Insurance Company provides NAFI members what I think is the best insurance plan on the market. And I'm not just saying that because I work for NAFI, but because I've seen the benefits and the coverages that they provide to NAFI members. And it's simply the best. And basically, if you're not familiar, years and years ago, they came to us and said, we want to make a insurance plan that NAFI members would be very proud of. What do you think we might need? And we gave them a list, and by golly, they used everything on the list, and they truly did a wonderful job putting this program together, and we thank them for their longtime support, not just of this program, but of NAFI. So if you're interested as a NAFI member, feel free to go to either nafinet.org/insurance, or you can go to Avemco's page directly at www.avemco.com/NAFI. You can get all the information there. You can give them a call, and I guarantee you that their customer service is top-notch. They will be able to help you with all of your questions, and I think you'll walk away happy. So thank you for Avemco for sponsoring this podcast, and this episode is a special one because it is a Beth Stanton takeover. Yes, you know it. It's another Writers Behind the Stories episode, and Beth has taken the liberty of interviewing longtime mentor contributor and 11-time NAFI Master Instructor. He's one of 10 instructors in the world to have ever gotten more than 10 Master Instructor accreditations, and he's done 11. And I think he's even working on his 12th, which is just huge. And so you get to learn a little bit about Steve, a little bit about sort of what drives him to be such an amazing instructor and a prolific instructor at that. He also has a long time military background as well. So he's done a little bit of everything, helicopters and the whole thing. So I will let the two of them talk about all of that. But I think you're in for a treat. And the Writers Behind the Stories episodes are always just amazing to listen to. So I hope you feel the same way. And remember, if you are a listener to this podcast, and how else would you be hearing this if you were? Anybody who listens can use the discount code POD49, P-O-D-4-9, and get $10 off their next renewal, or if you want to use it to join. So it's an exclusive discount for this podcast. I hope you use it. In the meantime, follow us on all of our social media accounts, and follow this podcast. And without further ado, I hope you enjoy Writers Behind the Story with Beth Stanton and special guest Steve Rutland.
Welcome to NAFI's More Right Rudder podcast. I'm Beth Stanton, Director of Publications and Editor for NAFI. This is the Writers Behind the Stories, a bi-monthly series where we meet some of the authors who write for NAFI's Mentor magazine. Today's guest is Steve Rutland. Steve has been flying for 50 years and has more than 20,000 accident-free hours. He has been a CFI since 1978 and has given 17,400 flight hours of dual instruction and another 2,200 in full motion simulators. He has trained students in 6 helicopter types and 7 airplane types. He is a triple rated ATP, has 5 flight instructor certificates, is an 11-time master flight instructor, and recently received the Wright Brothers Master Pilot Award. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, Steve, dude, I don't know if I've ever met anybody who has as much friggin' experience as you do. Like, I'm just reading those numbers and I'm just like, how is this possible?
Well, I started as a flight instructor full time in 1982 at Fort Rucker, which is now Fort Novosel. And I started teaching instruments in the UH-1. And after a couple of years of teaching instruments, I took a Department of the Army civilian job, which was civil service. And I transferred from the instrument field to the field which was teaching tactics and combat skills. And so my syllabus went from 2 hours a day to 4.5 hours a day every day. That was 90 hours a month. Now, that was how much time we were supposed to get on the students. We couldn't do it because it was really an impossible task. But I did that for many, many years. And I built up quite a bit of flight time there as a flight instructor. And then I continued civil service for almost 30 years. And then I separated from that and I went back to the contractor and I've worked there. So I've been at Fort Rucker or Fort Novosel now for almost 40 years as a flight instructor.
It
And then
is.
in the around 97, 98 time frame, I started to do fixed wing for Wallace College. And I would fly fixed wing there on the weekends and in the afternoons whenever I could. And I did that for with Wallace College and the Double British Aviation. I did it almost 20 years. So built up a little bit of flight time going to work every day.
Well, and what's, I don't even, there are so many avenues I want to explore with you because, okay, you have a military background and civilian background. You teach rotorcraft and you teach fixed wing. You have all of these ATP ratings and you've just been doing it over such a long period of time. I can't even begin to scratch the surface of imagining all of the changes that you've seen over your illustrious career as flight instruction. So I'm just like I am like in awe of you, Steve. I just can't believe. And there you are, sort of sitting there. It looks like with your leather jacket, being like your super cool 20,000 hour plus CFI badass. So I guess. Can you talk to us a little bit about how is it different between teaching military pilots and teaching civilian pilots? I understand that there's quite a difference in the structure. Can you just kind of give us a brief overview of some of the things that you find the biggest differences?
Well, with civilian students, I've only taught airplane. I've not taught helicopter. It's a much more relaxed pace for the most part. The student is paying for the training, and so you can take the approach or the pace. Pretty much at what they can deal with. In the military, you've got so many hours for whatever syllabus or whatever course you're on. That's about all the hours you're going to have. And so you have to get the student prepared to take their check ride at the end of that amount of training time. And the military is very, they're regimented and they're very strict in how they apply their oral information that they expect students to know and all this type of thing. They're very, I don't know, the word I would use is they're very regimented in how they that flight training.
So how
So
does that
it's more
change
laid
when,
back than civilian.
so how does that change your approach when you're working with your flight students?
Well, I don't know that it changes my approach a whole lot. I'm always trying to convey the information that I need to convey, and I'm always trying to get the students to perform the maneuvers that I'm trying to get them to perform. Most of the time in flight instructing, it's really a game of patience. Some students you just over and over and over again the same maneuver until they can finally get it, and then with others, the very few, I would say in most cases, they get it on the first or second time, and then life is really good after that.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I think like Flight instruction, it's a game of patience. That's like, that should be like on a marquee billboard, because it is, you can't, as much as you might feel frustrated or annoyed or impatient or head scratching, you can't really show that. You have to dig in and kind of maybe come up with a different, I know, for example, in my flight training, I was having a bit of a trouble with flying a stabilized traffic pattern and landing the plane so that you could use it again. And my instructor at one point, he's like, you need to go fly with somebody else. You know, I can't see it, which was, you know, kudos to him. So yeah, sometimes it just, I don't want to say some of us are denser than others, but you know, sometimes we all have our challenges.
Yeah, there are certain students that are definitely a challenge. We call it down in the trenches when you're just scratching your head, doing everything you can possibly do to get the student to meet the standards in the specified time.
And but I think that's
a very patience game.
It's patience, and it's also creative, though, Steve, I would imagine, because if you've taught, let's say you've taught 20 people this some skill or some technique, and the 21st person doesn't get it, you have to sort of shift your gears and be like, how can I teach this in a way that they're going to get it? Because doing it the way you did before is not working with this individual. So there's also, I would imagine, a creative aspect into like, okay, what trick can I pull out of my bag? I don't know, maybe you're inventing a new trick.
Well, you have to consider that every student's different from every other student. And you always have a little bit different approach with every student that you get. And you perceive pretty early on what motivates the student, what allows them to pick up on the information or the maneuver you're trying to convey as opposed to another student. And you try to take that approach. But you're right. You certainly can't use the same thing with every student because they're all so different.
And I'm sure every flight instructor who's listening to this conversation is nodding their head yes. One of the other things that I find so fascinating about your experience and background, Steve, is that in addition to the civilian versus military thing, you have the helicopter versus airplane thing, which again, you know, I've been working on learning how to fly helicopters, and it is nothing like flying airplanes. And so teaching helicopters is really nothing like teaching airplanes. They fly very differently. So tell me a little bit about going back and forth between teaching fixed wing and helicopters. How is that? And I'm sure there's some CFIs who are listening to this who are both fixed wing and rotorcraft instructors, and they're nodding their heads. But for those CFIs who are not, what are some of the challenges or differences between teaching these two different types of aircraft?
Well, I got my first fixed wing CFI, I guess back in 1978, but I didn't use it very much. I started teaching helicopter as a profession in 82, and I really didn't start doing the fixed wing until around 97 or 98. And I was well ingrained with the helicopter training by that point. And then when I started teaching fixed wing in that time, so I worked with Wallace College. They kind of got me up to speed a little bit on flying airplanes again. And it wasn't that much of a problem to go from one to the other. I mean, I knew what I was doing pretty much with the helicopters I was training in. And I picked up on what I needed to do with the fixed wing. He would always give me the CFI student because I had over 200 hours of CFI time. So I got most of those students. So they were smart and they helped me out a lot. And,
we learn so much from our students, don't we?
Oh, yeah, certainly. There's a lot you can learn from your students. I still do, even now, quite a bit.
Wow, I just love that. You know, I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, like sometimes you're watching these action movies and like they come along and they like, you know, steal the helicopter or the airplane to like get out of their sticky situation. I'm thinking if I was ever in a like running with that type of crowd, I'd want you around because you could like jump into any aircraft and fly it. You could fly us away.
I don't know. You first got to get it started. That might be a problem.
You know, I'm watching that Masters of the Air series, about that World War II that's sort of focusing on the B-17s. And they're right now, they're in the POW camp. And I was saying to my partner, Dan, I'm like, this is like what Bob Hoover did. He like got in a plane and actually escaped from a German POW camp by, and I mean, that type of thing is just like, it's like the stuff of like fantasy or like Hollywood, but Bob Hoover actually did that. So yeah, I believe he made the guy started the plane for him at gunpoint, I believe.
Yeah, I actually met him a time or two. He kept his airplane in the hangar that I worked in Los Angeles.
Really?
I was in the Coast Guard there. He had a Shrike that he kept in there, I think.
Of course. Wow.
And I went to a couple of his air shows.
Yeah.
I didn't know him very well, but I did meet him.
Legend, legend. Yeah. Well, you know, and of course, I know you'd be very, very, very humble to compare yourself to anybody, but you know, again, Steve, have to think that it's a very small amount of aviators today or ever that have achieved the amount of flight hours and experience that you've had. And you know, I'm laughing because you're just like, okay, everybody, this is the first time I've seen Steve. We've emailed a whole bunch and we've talked on the phone, but like you're just a cool cucumber, you know. So let me ask you this question. Can student pilots still surprise you with their shenanigans when they're learning how to fly? Or have you just absolutely seen it all?
Oh, no. I don't think you ever see it all. They definitely can surprise you.
More, what's more the late what's an example of the latest thing that surprised you?
Well, I can go back a few years.
Okay.
When I was teaching terrain flight, down on the trees, you know, in OE, about as low as you could fly and hovering along in a helicopter, students would invariably roll the throttle off of me. And that really took me by surprise first time it happened.
What would they do? Repeat that?
They would roll the throttle off in the UH-1. So, you know, you're shutting the fuel off to the engine. The engine's going to not deliver very much power to the rotor. So the first time that happened to me, it really took me by surprise. That was one of the most surprise events I guess I had. But after that, I got smart. I kept my hand right on. I had to take my hands off at that time because a student in the back was lost, not looking at the map to try to show him where he was. And so that student got me. And a lot of times in helicopters, when you're doing touchdown maneuvers to the ground in single engine aircraft, there's not a lot of leeway. There's, you know, you've got to do it right the first time because you just don't have that RPM once you bring the engine back to idle. You just got one pull or so of that collected, and that's it. So it's got to be right. Attitude's got to be right. And when you do stalls with you know, students in aircraft, they can get you in trouble if you're not paying attention to what you're doing. So I'm not saying that they're that dangerous, but you just got to pay attention. And I try to do that.
Yeah. So this leads me to wonder, is it, and I'm sure, you know, they're two separate but similar situations, teaching in fixed wing and teaching in rotorcraft. Do you find that there's one that's inherently more challenging, or are they both challenging their own way?
Well, they are challenging in their own way, but helicopters in the past, they're much more unstable than airplanes. They're getting more and more stable with new computerized systems and, you know, all that technology coming out. But in the past, they were very much unstable as compared to a fixed wing. So, you know, you had to teach the student to overcome that lack of stability and be able to fly that aircraft. Because when you're flying a helicopter, you're flying that rotor disc up there. You're not flying the fuselage of the aircraft. And every time you move that cyclic, that rotor system's going to tilt, and it's going to put a, you know, corresponding input into what the aircraft's doing. A lot of times, students can't hold it in a 40-foot field for the first few days. They just can't. But after a while, they learn.
Like anything, right? Repetition, practice.
Repetition.
Yeah.
Repetition and patience. Back to patience.
So, I want to talk a little bit about your involvement with NAFI and also your involvement over the years with Mentor Magazine, writing articles for Mentor. So it's been about 2 years since I've been NAFI's editor, and you submitted some articles for me. And actually, you have an article that's in the March-April issue that just recently went live. But you've had other articles that you've written for me, and then my predecessor, David Hipschman, you have written articles. So let me ask you a couple questions. When did you join NAFI? Well, when did you join NAFI and why did you join NAFI?
I think I joined NAFI around 99, 98, 99. I was working full time as a Department Army civilian instructor at Fort Rucker, Fort Novosel, and that's when I started working for Wallace College, and I started looking at the organizations that were out there that were available, and I said, oh, I'm going to join NAFI and see what this is, National Association of Flight Instructors.
And after you joined, what did you find? Obviously, you're still a member all these years later, so you must have found some benefit in it. So when you first joined NAFI, what sort of things did you take advantage of?
Well, you know, they had their Master CFI program, and I did that in 2000. I think I finished that for the first time in 2000. And, you know, I like to read their magazine. Their magazine back then, Adventure, was only about, you know, 15 pages long. But, you know, you gleaned from it what you could. And it was nice to be affiliated with a national organization that was standing up for flight instructors. Flight instructors have never really been, in my opinion, you know, compensated for what the work they do, and they have a hard time getting the training aircraft that they need to train with, and the equipment they need to train with. So I was glad to be with an organization that was promoting that.
So you said you joined NAFI in 99, so that was 25 years ago, if I do my math correctly. And so tell us, when did you first write an article for Mentor Magazine, and do you remember when that was?
Yeah, I think I wrote my first one in 2005, 2004 or 5, somewhere around
okay,
there.
Okay, so you've been writing for about 20 years then for Mentor.
They wanted me to write an article on helicopters, and so I wrote it on auto rotations. Probably wasn't my best work, but anyway, they published it.
Well, again, sort of circling back, we, you know, practice and patience, right, Steve? You said it.
Yeah.
So you said they asked you to write an article about helicopters. So I was going to ask you, why did you decide to start writing for Mentor? So it sounds like maybe you were asked to write one, but then in the years that followed, you've been compelled to write articles and submit them. So what is your rationale and reasoning behind wanting to write and submit articles to Mentor Magazine?
I started writing articles largely on safety issues that I had been involved with over the years, and certain things that I had done that probably wasn't the smartest thing in the world, and try to give that information to other people. I see every accident just about, you know, coming out, whatever the cause, it's pilot error, right? There's an old joke that we have here: if you're involved in an aviation accident as a pilot, and it's not material failure, then you have a 100% chance of it being pilot error. If it is material failure, then you have a 99% chance of it being pilot error. So I tried to focus on a lot of safety type issues, and that's what I wrote about, how to be safe as a flight instructor, and some of the mistakes I've made that I got away with, but, you know, I guess I was fortunate.
You know, I have to say, one of my favorite types of articles, if not the favorite type of article that I like to receive and read, is that type of article about people saying, hey, guess what, you guys, I screwed the pooch on this, and it could have had a different outcome, and I lucked out. And it's sort of like, you know, the saying, we don't have to make all the same mistakes, we can learn from others' mistakes. And I also love it. So it's such a service to the community, because guess what? If you made that mistake, I'm guessing there's thousands of people who have also made that same damn mistake. And I like it because it's vulnerable, and it puts your ego aside, because, you know, pilots like to puff their chests out a lot and, you know, look how great I am, Mr., you know, Top Gun pilot. And sort of present this infallible, excellent facade, which we're all infallible. We all can be excellent too, by the way. And that's always a good thing to show, is our excellence, but we can all make mistakes. And so I love it when people can be like, yeah, I did this. And you know what, maybe if I did it this way, it would have been better. So I love that you do that.
Yeah, one of the better ones I wrote, was I titled it The Wrong Decision That Was Mine and Whether That I Should Not Have Gotten Into with a Student, but I wrote it all up in the article.
Yeah, so. No, I love that because, you know, again, you just got done saying, you know, you've been flying for what, 64 years now?
No, yeah, I've only been flying for 50 years.
Oh, only 50, sorry, 50 years. Okay, so I was gonna say 64 years. When did you start? When you were like three?
I started in 73, so
yeah,
January 74.
So after even 5 decades of flight training, you're still learning, and one would say, you know, maybe still making some mistakes here and there, and you're learning from that. And it's, I think of like Tai Chi masters or martial art masters. You never get there. You're always learning.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I know every day that something can get me at any time. I'm well aware of that. And so I try to plan for that. I mean, I respect that. That's what I guess I'm trying to say. I don't try to be afraid of it, but I know it's always there. So I'm always watching for what can I do to be careful. And,
when I think about it, I think it's really about risk mitigation. And Aaron Dabney, one of NAFI's board members, he also helps to produce Mentor Live each month, NAFI's free webinar broadcast to the aviation community. Aaron has actually recently wrote a piece that talks about that, you know, like aviation can kill you dead, right? And it can kill anybody dead. And, you know, you don't want to be afraid of that, but you want to plan for that. And so there's risk mitigation that you can enact. And there's lots of different, you know, categories of what we can call risk mitigation. And then, you know, for example, for Richard McSpadden's death, you know, somebody who's, you know, the most safety conscious person in the world, you know, nobody's immune to having a bad day in an aircraft. So, but you stack the deck in your favor when you have that type of mentality.
Well, I think most successful pilots and flight instructors have that mentality all the time. They are constantly aware, you know, of the situation that you're doing. So,
well, and I think it's so important. And it's so, we're so grateful, Steve, like people like you, people of your caliber and your experience. And listen, every flight instructor, no matter how many years they've been flying, everybody has their valuable experience. But when you get somebody who's been flying for 5 decades, you got some cred behind what you say. And it's so valuable for you to pass along this. I like to call it like the tribal knowledge, is like we are passing along this tribal knowledge to the next generation. And it's just so important that we do this. And that's really what we do at Mentor Magazine, is it's a magazine that has content by CFIs for CFIs. And like you said, when you first joined, reading the 15-page magazine, you gleaned information from it. You know, doesn't matter how many pages it is, it's really the quality of it and the information that is in there.
Very much true.
So over your years of teaching, how is it different now than when you started? And I would like to ask this from two perspectives, Steve. One, from a personal perspective, like how is it different for you teaching now as it was when you first started in the 80s, from a personal perspective? And then also, how is it different from an industry perspective? Because the industry has changed a lot in the last 40, 50 years too.
I started training when I was in college, and I was in the ROTC flight program, and you know, they hired a contractor to get set training, and it was very small airport, small operation, and you know, pretty much one-on-one with the flight instructor. And I think we got really good instruction on what we were doing. It was not in detail about a lot of things that I do now, but I thought it was good instruction. And I got good instruction in the military. For sure. training has changed some, but we still deal with the problems of, you know, training aircraft. We need to improve them as much as we can. I would like to see training go a little bit more toward the collegiate level or to a institutional level where, you know, it's very well controlled and everything is pretty much kept in check. I don't point any fingers at people who fly on the weekends and do flight instruction, because some of them are the best there is out there. I know they are. I've seen them. I've worked with them, and they do a remarkable job. But I just think we would be better off if we had a little more structured program with flight instructing. That's my opinion on what it's worth. But again, I'm not pointing fingers at any of them, because I've seen some of the best who do it on the weekends.
So are you thinking of part 61 versus part 141? Is it, so are you?
Well, yeah, but even more than part 140. I've taught both 61 and 141. And 141 is structured a little bit more because, you know, the VA is paying part of the price there. But, the colleges and universities who have the equipment and they have the instructor always available to teach, or at least they're probably more so than what you would see just with a, you know, a random school, they probably do a little bit better job with the student. And you got to keep the student motivated. You got to keep them going in the beginning anyway. You know, that's my opinion.
So how is how is it different for you? Like as a pilot now, and I know you're really busy. And by the way, everybody, Steve recently emailed me. It was about a month or so ago, a few weeks ago. And you were talking about like, your days start early and they're long, and it's almost like, this is getting hard for me. You know, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. And this is, and so you're, and I was like, I was just so in awe of that. And I asked you, like, why do you still do this, Steve? And Steve actually wrote a wonderful article, short article, about why he's still teaching, which, by the way, is going to be printed at some point in the near future. So I don't want to give too much of that away, but so you obviously love it, because you get up and you get in the car and you go to the airport every day or most days and teach. So how is it different for you personally now than it was, you know, just, and not just in the beginning, but over the course of your career teaching?
Well, now I teach mainly in my Lakota, which is an EC-145 twin engine helicopter. Now I teach beginning students in primary, and then I take them through the instrument phase. And I'm pretty pleased with the training course that we have and the amount of training time that we have and, you know, the amount of information we're required to teach. I still enjoy it, I guess. My wife says it's your purpose in life, and when you give it up, you're not going to know what to do with yourself. I retired for a couple of years, and I didn't know what to do with myself. And so I went back to teaching at Fort Novosel. And I like working with the military. You know, they're very young officers, and I guess they help keep me young a little bit, working with them. And I do enjoy it. And, you know, I've been a slow learner over the years. I was going to tell you this. I've been through 10 instructor pilot courses at Fort Rucker, Fort Novosel, each course, you know, being about anywhere from 6 weeks to 2 months, or at least over a month. So I think my logbook shows 623 hours of dual receive. So I know I'm a very slow learner. So I had to have all this training so I can train students now.
Well, you know, I think us slow learners, we need to cut ourselves a little slack. I'm a person, and I, you know, it's maybe sort of reframe it as repetition. So basically what we call slow is we just need to be exposed to the material more than once, and maybe in a different way. And also, you know, we learn at different levels. So we can learn at a rote memorization level, and then we learn from an experiential level, like, oh, that's what they were talking about. And then we learn at yet another level when we teach it. So, you know, in addition to just repetition, I think there's also a deepening of our knowledge. You know, when you first got in the plane or helicopter with your very first student, you had a very different level of depth of knowledge then. And it's not to say that you weren't an effective flight instructor at that moment on hour one, but now at hour friggin' 17,000 or whatever you are, you know, you have a more depth of knowledge at this point.
Well, I do have a more depth of knowledge, certainly. I have definitely learned to be more mellow, I think, than what I was when I first started out. I was more intense at that time. I'm much more laid back, I think, now. I still have to get them done in the amount of time that I have to get them done, but I try to be as understanding with them as I possibly can. And again, you've got to have the patience. If you don't, you're just not going to get there.
I look at instructors like you and actually pretty much every instructor I've ever worked with over the years. And I'm almost like, everybody seems like unflappable, like nothing, like I'm sure inside sometimes it's like, you put on a good poker face, but it's almost just like there's this preternatural calm where you have to keep, pardon my French, you have to keep your shit together so that the whole flight, you know what I mean? So like if somebody's melting down or like task saturated and losing it, you have to keep it together yourself. And so I would imagine that's also kind of a learned skill, because I think as humans, we're wired to kind of like have that, you know, self protective, I want to stay alive thing going on.
Well, you have to keep the flight under control at all times, no matter what's happening. And there may be a time or two when you look a little bit worried about what's happening and you don't want to pass that on to the student. It's okay to tell them that, you know, situation may be getting serious, but you don't want to get them alarmed.
Sure. Yeah.
And I try my best to put my, you know, kind of put myself in their shoes, because I've been in their shoes and I kind of know what it is to sit on their side of the table. And I try to take, you know, their viewpoint on a lot of things, on what they're going through. And that's kind of the way I do my flight instruction.
I love that. I love that so much, because that gives you, you know, just gives you so much compassion and insight. And yeah, because I think, you know, and I'm not talking about flight instruction, but there's just a lot of instruction in general. You know, when you're doing something brand new, you have no freaking clue what you're doing. And
that's
if
right.
You forget what it was like to learn, you could be get impatient or snappy and make the student feel less than, and that's not going to be good for anybody. So I'm glad that you did that. I'm sure your students are glad too.
You got to constantly remember that, you know, they have an ego to maintain as well. You got to do what you can to encourage them.
Well, just think of like you don't want to crush a child. Like, you know, if a little kid goes to kindergarten is learning their ABCs and they kind of, they skip over one of the letters and you're like, you're stupid. Why didn't you learn this? You know, you know, that's not good. The poor kid. Same thing. We're all that way when we learn something new.
For sure. And again, that goes back to the repetition.
So what, I'm curious about this question now, Steve. What is your greatest joy when it comes to flight training, over all your years of training? What brings you the greatest joy and makes you smile?
I still get you know, a real kick out of watching the students go up there and take their check ride, and they come back and they say, oh, everything went great, and I didn't have any problem with anything, and I appreciate what you taught me. And, you know, that's kind of the reward that I get at the end of the phase of training.
Yeah, like proud papa. Like, you did it. You know, when we were talking about how flight training has changed over the years and how it stayed the same, one of the things I wanted to bring up was flight simulation. Now, you have more than 2,000 hours teaching in flight simulators, and flight simulation technology has improved vastly over the decades. Even I would say within the last 5 or 10 years, it's entirely more advanced than it was even, you know, 10, 20 years ago. Tell us a little bit about what it's like to teach in simulators. And you have done quite a bit of sim training, and not all CFIs have done that. So tell us a little bit about what you like about teaching in SIMS and how it can help the students in their progression to becoming pilots.
Well, the simulators that I've trained in, I've trained in the UH-1 and UH-60, and as well as the Lakota. Most of them that I've trained in are full motion simulators. They are excellent for instrument training in most cases. They're just, you can really stop the training, freeze the trainings, go back and talk about whatever you were doing, and then resume the training. And you have the opportunity to do a number of different approaches at different places and so on and forth that you can't do in the real world. So I think they're excellent instrument trainers. The computer-generated imagery that I see for a lot of the visuals is not as good as what I would consider for the instruments. But you can do all of the emergency maneuvers. You can shut down an engine and or shut down your own engine for that matter. And you're not worried about an accident or you're doing any of the type of emergencies that you normally would do in real life. It's has that element of risk. But again, instruments is the best part of that training in the simulators. And I know that the modern airliners and all that, they have the visuals that are just as good as the instruments, but I haven't quite got to that just yet.
Well, and it comes from a, and I have heard that before with it with instruments because, instead of having to like fly another 15 minutes to set up for an approach, you just boop hit the computer. So you save time and you save money. So, I
You
mean, both of those
absolutely
things, it's
do.
more efficient.
And
So,
someone is sophisticated enough that they are very close to what real life flying is like. If you can fly instruments in the simulators, some of the simulators I've been in, you can fly in the aircraft.
that's
Very
fantastic.
little add-on. You can do it.
That's great to know. And for students, instructors, whether you're getting adding on a rating, seek out flight simulators. There's different price points and different organizations and entities have them. Obviously, you have to find one, and they're expensive to purchase for flight schools,
Yeah,
but
very
it could
expensive.
definitely be worth an investment.
Well, see, that's where these institutions that can afford that, they have that to offer that you may not see just on the flying schools that don't have those kind of resources.
Yeah, so maybe ask like what are your resources? Yeah, for sure. So as we kind of wrap up here, Steve, I have a couple of final questions I'd like to ask you. One, what would you say to a NAFI member who's listening to this podcast, who's listening to this and has listened to other podcast episodes about the folks who've written for Mentor, and they're thinking, I have this story, I have this idea, I have this thing that I think I might want to write about, but they haven't written about it yet. What would you tell that individual?
Well, I think if they're really serious about wanting to write it, just go ahead and write it. Do the best you can. I'm not the best at proofreading by any stretch, but if you've got somebody that might help you with that a little bit, and get it written, proofread it, and send it in and see what happens. I mean, there's a lot of good ideas out there from a lot of different people, and I think everyone who's interested in doing that should go ahead and give it a shot.
Awesome. And then I also like to say, this is why God invented editors. You don't have to write a perfect draft.
There you
And
go.
this, we have the elfin magic of fixing punctuation and grammar and sentence structure. And so yeah, it'll get polished up and put a nice little bow on it before it gets printed. So yeah, I think a lot of times, myself included, perfection can get in the way of producing things. And so if we can just kind of let go of that perfection and just like be brave enough to put something out there, and not worry about maybe any, if it wasn't perfect, that's okay. We're all works in progress. So
Absolutely. I mean, I've learned a lot about writing just, the few articles that I've written for Mentor. I think I've gotten a little bit better at some of them. So if that's your passion and you really have something you'd like to say, go for it.
yeah, and I've been writing professionally for a really long time, and I go back and look at some of the first stuff I wrote, and I'm like, even stuff that's been published in major, publications, and I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, so, you know, you just, but it was still good, you know, but you just get better. Kind of like flying. Like, you get your ticket, you're private pilot, you can fly, you know, you just pass the test, you can fly, but you're going to get better the more you do it. So, but you have to do it to get better. So the last thing I would like to talk about, and I'm so proud of you for this. You just recently were awarded the Wrights Brother Master Pilot Award. And I'm just like, that is such a pinnacle of achievement in aviation. It just says so much about an individual. And you guys, you know, again, Steve and I emailed back and forth, and it was just a few weeks ago, right, that you you received it, and he emailed me, and he had a picture of him receiving it, and I was just like, oh, I was just like so proud of you, Steve. I'm just like, it's so it's just such an accomplishment. What did it feel like to get that award?
Well, the company that I worked for, the director here at Fort Novosel, he just went out of his way, and everybody in the hierarchy just went out of the way that they asked me to invite anybody I wanted to invite. And, you know, they had a nice presentation with the FAA, as well as the military was there, and as well as the company. And it was pretty much a packed room. There was well over 100 people in there, and he just made a real nice presentation, and I was just very appreciative of receiving that. I've been lucky. I've been fortunate to fly the hours that I've flown. And, you know, I've had, I guess, 4 engine failures over the years, and 11 or 12 bird strikes, and I don't know what all else, other hydraulics failures and other things, but no great airmanship on my part. Everything just worked out pretty well. So I've been real fortunate there, and I was very fortunate to receive the Wright Brothers.
Well, congratulations. And, you know, from NAFI and all of these students you've taught, probably thousands of students that you've taught over these last 50 years, you know, thank you for your service to the aviation community, your service to our country, your service to NAFI. You are the pinnacle of somebody who gives back to the community. And I know you're also a very humble person. And there might be a kind of aw shucksness that you're feeling right now, but I want you to friggin' own it, Steve. you've done great things, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you for being here. This was a great conversation. I got to know more about you. So with that, everyone, thank you for joining us for the Writers Behind the Stories on NAFI's More Right Rudder podcast. And be sure to leave your comments, like, subscribe, and join me next time in a couple of months. And I invite you to consider sharing your stories in Mentor Magazine. We'll see you next time on the Writers Behind the Stories on NAFI's More Right Rudder podcast.